Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the very real possibility, expressed by Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, that Russian forces might soon cross the border into Ukraine and enter a war with Ukraine's military, which is poised to defeat the pro-Russian rebel insurgency in its eastern provinces. Andrew Cutchins, a senior fellow and director of the Center for Strategic and International Relations Russia and Eurasia Program, joins us to discuss what NATO's response might be and the dire need for a face-saving diplomatic intervention to find a way out for Putin, who has whipped up nationalistic fervor in Russia to a fever pitch and may not be able to ride the tiger of his own propaganda. Then we will speak with one of the nation's leading investigative journalists, Charles Lewis, who is the founder of the Center for Public Integrity and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. We will look into the growing corporatization of the press and the rising influence of public relations at a time while investigative reporting and beat coverage of the activities of federal, state, and local governments is in decline. We will also discuss his new book, just out, 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. Then finally, with the White House planning to circumvent Congress to stop tax benefits for U.S. companies that relocate overseas to lower their taxes, we will speak with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. We will discuss the issue of economic patriotism with $2.5 trillion in cash stashed abroad by American corporations and what can be done to stop the flood of these corporate inversions as giant American companies move their headquarters abroad to avoid paying taxes to the U.S. Treasury. And joining us now is Andrew Cutchins, who is a senior fellow and director of the Center for Strategic and International Relations Russia and Eurasia Program, as well as the former director of the Russian and Eurasian Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His recent publications include Perspective, What's to Follow the Demise of the U.S.-Russian Reset, The End of the Reset, and Russian Foreign Policy, Continuity in Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Cutchins.
Hey, Ian, my pleasure to be with you again.
Likewise, Andrew. And today, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, speaking before the U.S. European Command in Stuttgart, Germany, agreed with the Polish foreign minister that Russian forces on the Ukrainian border pose a risk of an invasion. The secretary said, I think it is a reality. And he went on to talk about the build-up, the sophistication of the troops, the training of the troops, the heavy military equipment that's on the border. It's a threat. It's a possibility. Absolutely. So I guess the question would be, if Putin pulls the trigger, what would the West do?
Well, if he were to pull the trigger on something that looked like, let's say, something more like a 1968 Czechoslovakia, you know, kind of no holds barred, you know, massive men and material, tanks, et cetera, and air support coming across the border, boy, I don't know exactly what we would do, to be perfectly honest. It would be a dreadful catastrophe, for sure, an all-out shooting war between Russia and Ukraine, which eventually Ukraine would most likely lose, but of course that would be dependent upon the possibility of whether NATO or the United States, more unilaterally, you know, were ready really to come to Ukraine's defense, which I don't think is likely. I mean, coming to the defense to the point of something like an Article 5 commitment to put boots on the ground and really defend Ukraine's sovereignty with Ukraine.
But yeah. Sorry to interrupt, but I guess the qualification here is that he's only got 20,000 troops, apparently, although some of them are special forces. So it doesn't look like it would be the kind of full-scale invasion that you're talking about. But it still would be a serious incursion, would it not?
Yeah, that's a fair point. And apparently, I think there are, you know, 15, 20 other 1,000 troops in the region. But it would be a very, very major, major incursion, a drastic escalation of the situation today. And frankly, one that I'm skeptical that Mr. Putin would go through with, at least at this stage in the game. But there's no question that we are at, and we have been at for several weeks, even before the shoot down of the Malaysian airliner, you know, kind of within a hair of of a shooting war between Russia and Ukraine, rather than the kind of proxy war that has been taking place for the last couple of months, or nearly the last couple of months since the ceasefire broke down in June.
But it seems to me that all throughout this, particularly before and after the shootdown of the Malaysian aircraft, that airliner, that what Putin is doing there is always calibrated to the gains of the Ukrainian army against his proxies, the so-called pro-Russian rebels. And indeed, I talked to Pavel Felgenhauer, a military analyst in Moscow at the time, after the shootdown, and he said that it was largely to do with the fact that the Ukrainians were making gains against the rebels, and he had to up the ante because they were airdropping supplies in to pockets of troops on the Russian border that were cutting off supplies coming in from Russia to the rebels. And clearly, by upping the ante, he created this catastrophe, which, by the way, what I find extraordinarily troubling is that my latest understanding of the polls in Russia, at least the reliable polls in Russia, are that only 3% of the Russian people believe that the pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine shot that aircraft down with a Russian-supplied missile. It's pretty depressing, isn't it, that Putin has created such an effective bubble in an alternative reality?
It's unbelievably depressing. I was in Moscow about 3 weeks ago for 3 or 4 days, and it was a few days before the Malaysian airliner was shot down. And, you know, I've been traveling to the Soviet Union and Russia for 35 years since I was an undergraduate student, and I've never seen anything like the propaganda campaign, the fervor, the fever that is in the message, the type of message, anti-Western message, extremely chauvinistic Russian nationalist message that's being conveyed to the people. And in many cases, simply just outright, complete lies. It's almost a situation where they're calling white black and black white. And, you know, again, you know, someone who spent a fair amount of time in the Soviet Union, which was kind of a living lie in and of itself, and where the role of propaganda was so important, to see us here, you know, nearly 23 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and an even more noxious propaganda environment is kind of mind-boggling. And the potential kind of longer-term ramifications of this, you know, I was never someone that believed in really a new Cold War. I don't really believe in a new Cold War simply because the Russians don't have the capabilities that the Soviet Union did, but they have enough capabilities to make things extremely difficult for their neighbors, and presenting us with a number of very different, very difficult policy decisions right now. And this is not, you know, I've been critical at times of the Obama administration, very critical of the Obama administration at times, how they've handled this, but there's certainly no easy solution right now. What I fear, Ian, is that perhaps Mr. Putin is weaker politically than we actually may want him to be. I think there are significantly more nationalist, chauvinist political elements around him in the Kremlin. And as former finance minister Alexei Kudrin said in an interview that was, I think, a very important interview published a couple of weeks ago by ITAR TASS, a Russian news agency, which he said that there's been sort of a coup d'etat by these nationalist forces around Putin. And when you watch TV and when you hear the messages coming from the Kremlin, it's hard not to agree with that.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Cutchins, who's a senior fellow and director of the Center for Strategic and International Relations, Russia and Eurasia Program, as well as the former director of the Russian and Eurasian Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His recent publications include Perspective, What's to Follow the Demise of the U.S.-Russia Reset, The End of the Reset, and Russian Foreign Policy Continuity and Change. So you've made a very clear and compelling and rather scary case that Putin is riding a tiger of nationalism, but he's largely stirred it up. And yeah. The cynical explanation for that, probably an accurate one, nevertheless, is that he simply is, you know, this is bread and circuses. He's distracting the Russian people from his misrule and the Siloviki's theft of the national treasury along with his. But having stirred this up, how does he quieten it down? He can't sell out his proxies, and he can't reverse this extraordinary alternative universe of propaganda, can he?
He certainly can't. Can't do it easily. You know, if only, you know, he were, you know, the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, but who was able to pull the levers and things would actually happen, then he may have the capacity to actually walk this back. But I'm afraid that it is not. It's just not so simple. I think that we're very close to the very, very dangerous point where if he believes that the insurgency that he cannot lose the insurgency in Ukraine, and clearly the Ukrainian military is continuing to effectively shut down the insurgency, then his option is going to be to escalate. And well, again, I don't think it's going to be the massive incursion escalation, at least in the next step, but you know, something more overt than the kind of slightly covert support that the Russians have been providing for the insurgents. The best case scenario, of course, would be somehow to find a face-saving way for Putin to get to a peaceful or negotiation toward a peaceful resolution of this. But it's an awfully hard challenge to come up with, and it doesn't appear that there has been much interest in Kiev, for sure, on that by Mr. Poroshenko. I'm a little concerned that Mr. Poroshenko may be feeling a bit too empowered by the successes of his military, and under the belief that he can continue and completely shut down the insurgency, and including whatever the Russians would do to escalate that. It's a very, very dangerous proposition, for sure. I understand his skepticism, you know, given the what happened with the last ceasefire in June, when basically the Russians used that as an opportunity to, you know, bolster the insurgents with more transfers of men and material across the border. Poroshenko decided to break the ceasefire because he felt that he was going to be looking at a fait accompli if he let that continue to happen.
So in terms of, though, a face-saving, I mean, I don't think leaders, and I'm referring here to President Obama, have the luxury of having opinions about the people they have to deal with in foreign policy, because as bad as the Korean guy is, you still have to deal with him, or somebody has to. And I believe that Obama really despises Putin, and these long phone calls apparently are very frustrating because Putin keeps repeating the same thing over and over again. And my understanding is that Putin really, because he's a former KGB guy and the Siloviki run Russia in large part, that he makes the assumption that somehow the CIA runs the United States and is behind this whole thing in Ukraine. And that's my understanding that of his mindset. He really is delusional about, you know, who's really in charge here, at least in the West. But, I mean, if Obama has outsourced this to Biden because he can't stand talking to Putin, that doesn't seem to be a luxury we can afford. I mean, how does Obama get over his peak at dealing with this guy and recognize that we could have a hot war here? And, you know, there are huge stakes. And I mean, I'm not suggesting that Obama doesn't recognize the stakes at play here, but I just don't feel there's sufficient engagement.
Yeah, that's been my fear, Ian, from the get-go, even with the first press conference from President Obama on February 28th, that he didn't fully appreciate the stakes that are out there with this. You know, his tendency is to kind of talk about this in a more analytical, kind of academic way, making the case that Russia is weak, they're doing this out of weakness, and that it is not in their long-term interest, et cetera, et cetera. Which, fine, that's true, but it certainly is not at all useful in addressing, you know, the problem that needs to be solved right now. And it would, you know, heck, this would be an opportunity for him to really earn the Nobel Prize that he got a few years ago, shortly after coming into power. But it would require him to really kind of step outside of his own skin, I think, and get his hands very, very, you know, dirty in trying to resolve this. And because the other, you know, where he also has to work with, of course, is in Kyiv with the Ukrainian leadership, Mr. Poroshenko in particular. Because, you know, I think the problem with imagining a negotiation is that, well, one, okay, the problem is the Russians don't admit that they are playing any role to support the insurgents. And so they will say, well, you know, this is for Mr. Poroshenko to work out with, you know, Mr. Borodai or Antifeyev or any of these kind of Russian proxy leaders of the you know, Donetsk People's Republic and Lugansk People's Republic. And then, you know, Poroshenko would say, well, you know, we don't recognize them as legitimate political leaders, so, you know, they are not to be negotiated with. You know, somebody, whether it's Mr. Obama or Mrs. Merkel or, you know, has to kind of, you know, look, you know, we're on the verge of a major catastrophe. We recognize that the sort of de jure problems that you have in kind of getting to a negotiation, but, you know, we have to just deal kind of de facto, concretely, in a way to prevent, you know, this from escalating. And I think, you know, maybe it would be best if the initiative were to come from Mr. Poroshenko, in that, I mean, the shape of a resolution, I think, has been out there, the kind of the pieces of it, which would include a commitment on Ukraine and NATO's part that Ukraine would not be a member of NATO for, you know, X amount of years, minimally. That the Ukrainian government would, as it is committed to do, to re-examine the federal structure of Ukraine, and provide, you know, greater autonomy for the Eastern Southern Republic so that they may desire it, but not going so far as to obviously to undermine the territorial sovereignty of Ukraine itself, you know, to provide the rights for language, education, to ethnic minorities, i.e. the Russians, but just in principle to Ukrainians itself. I mean, those pieces are there, but I mean, no one seems to be really kind of taking the bull by the horn, and kind of going and, you know, said, this is what we have to do. We have to do now. I think Mr. Poroshenko he's pursuing the anti-terrorist operation. And he wants to pursue it to the end. And
he also wants to get Crimea back, which is, you know, and how right, do you do that?
Well, I think the best case on Crimea is that there would be an agreement that the future of Crimea, well, first of all, that there is no de jure recognition that Crimea is part of the Russian Federation, but further that the political status of Crimea, you know, would be resolved at some distant point in the future. Because at least, you know, for the near term, there's just, you know, no way that, you know, realistically, the Crimea, in my view, is going to be, you know, de facto and de jure part of Ukraine. But, you know, the clock is ticking for Mr. Poroshenko, because Ukraine is in the midst of a major economic crisis, and having to fight this civil war is exacerbating that very, very significantly. Reading the economic figures today, that already the Ukrainian economy is looking at a 6-7% drop in its GDP for 2014. Its solvency is literally on the line, and we've known that that's the case, you know, going back 5 or 6 months, and well, even further than that, if you go back to the negotiations in November between the EU and Russia and Ukraine under Yanukovych, who really was kind of the economic dire straits of Ukraine that has kind of catalyzed the whole problem.
Well, just in closing then, Andrew Cutchins, what do you think, assuming that Angela Merkel, who I think is the person has the best relationship with Putin, they speak each other's languages and apparently there is at least some rapport there. I mean, obviously we need a face-saving mechanism, whatever it is, it's better than where we're heading now. But what do you think, though, in terms of how do you get around this, again, the delusion that Putin has that NATO is this huge juggernaut when, it's, as far as I can tell, it's a paper tiger. There are no American tanks left in Europe. Yet he thinks it's the demon. So do we roll over and show our soft underbelly? Is that the best way out? And say, look, you got nothing to worry about.
Well, it gets to the question, Ian. I think, you know, to what extent does Mr. Putin actually believe that, or to what extent is it simply very instrumentally useful for him for consolidating his domestic political position to take that, and that the core problem for me is that I think that what he's doing in Ukraine is driven a lot by domestic political concerns in Russia. And you know, he's been a very, very effective tactical operator over 14 years. My fear, though, is that with this play, beginning with the annexation of Crimea, he's badly, badly, badly miscalculated. But I think, you know, on the NATO issue, I think NATO simply has to suck it up, along with Mr. Poroshenko, to simply agree that, look, Ukraine's not going to be a member of NATO for X amount of time. I mean, if that's going to be part of what it takes to resolve this and avoid the catastrophe, which we are just a hair away from as we speak, then, you know, we're going to have to do it. You know, it's not an ideal world, and we don't want to make the better the enemy of the good, or in this case the good the enemy of simply avoiding complete catastrophe.
Right. Well, Andrew Cutchins, I appreciate the conversation. I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Cutchins, who's a senior fellow and director of the Center for Strategic and International Relations, Russia and Eurasia program, as well as the former director of the Russian and Eurasian program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His recent publications include Perspective, What's to Follow the Demise of the U.S.-Russia Reset, and The End of the Reset, and Russian Foreign Policy Continuity in Change. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with one of the nation's leading investigative journalists. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Charles Lewis, who's a best-selling author with over 30 years' experience as a national investigative journalist, a professor of journalism, and the founding executive editor of the Investigative Reporting Workshop at the School of Communication at American University. He is a former producer for ABC News and CBS's 60 Minutes, as well as the founder of the Center for Public Integrity and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. His new book just out is 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Lewis.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And in terms of the 935 lies, which relate to the accounting of the lies or mistruths or misstatements by George W. Bush in the lead up to the Iraq War, In total, though, the book looks at the various ways in which truth can be manipulated and distorted by governments, corporations, and even individuals. One of the things I find disturbing a trend here in the United States is the extent to which the sort of town square has disappeared and that there's no sort of consensus anymore about what is true. Liberals get their information from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, Christians from Christian Broadcasting, and people do their own reality shopping. So in terms of the truth itself, how much do you think the truth is up for grabs in current American culture?
Well, unfortunately, it's pretty totally up. It's totally up for grabs. Let me give an example. As late as 2012, 62% of Republicans, according to one poll, still thought there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That's approximately 8 years after President George W. Bush himself acknowledged they weren't there. So people cling to their beliefs. And if people hear something over and over and over, even if it's not true, they actually tend to believe it's true. There's actually like a scientific term for that. But it is true. Folks go to their own group of folks ideologically or otherwise that they're comfortable with religiously or other reasons. And it is an increasing tendency. I think it's a very, very serious tendency. You know, we've gone a long way since 90% of the American people listened and watched three TV networks back in the 60s. So something has happened over time in a lot of different ways, as we all know. We've lived through all kinds of various things. Media has changed. Cable TV came in the 80s. The web came in the 90s. And Fox News came in also in the last 20, 25 years. And all of these things have combined, especially in the information age, into the battle of soundbites, essentially, and arguments and people posturing and then audiences developing around those things. And the rest of the masses, the folks who don't care about politics, they're into sports or other issues, don't listen at all. And it's a long, involved story. But the bottom line is, yeah, we have a problem here with our democracy. We do not have a town square increasingly. We only have half the country participating in presidential elections. We have about 10 or 20%, if we're lucky, in local elections, participating in elections. And so there's all kinds of related subjects here to the state of our democracy and, by the way, truth and information.
But it's curious and paradoxical. We just started out today's program talking about how dangerous the situation is on the Ukrainian border with Russian troops massing. And I spoke to a specialist on Russia who just returned from Moscow and was appalled at the propaganda bubble in which the entire country has been enveloped by Vladimir Putin, to the extent that recent polling in Russia indicates that only 3% of the Russian people believe that the pro-Russian rebels shot down the Malaysian airliner with a Russian-supplied missile. And yet we pride ourselves on being a democracy and we castigate Russia. I mean, obviously, 3% is a pretty appalling figure here, but it shows you the power of propaganda. Is there any way to use those examples to wake Americans up that we're on a slippery slope?
Well, I hope so. I think that that ought to wake folks up. Every country on earth, including the United States, attempts in terms of the official governments of these countries attempt to control and succeed in largely shaping and controlling perceptions. It's not a Republican or Democratic thing. Every president in the last 10 years has added more PR, you know, press folks in their White House than the preceding folks. No one's had more than the current president, for example. Now we have tweets, emails, radio shows, TV shows, I mean, all kinds of video, all kinds of things coming out of the White House, and we actually have fewer reporters covering it. We've lost one-third of all of our professional paid journalists in the United States in recent years for various economic reasons relating to the Internet and advertising, et cetera. So we have more people telling us what the truth is, and fewer of them are actually professional journalists who theoretically are independent or, you know, nonpartisan and somewhat hopefully independent. So this is a problem in countries all over the world. Obviously, Russia and China have the tightest grip in terms of the society on information. But, of course, the U.S. has these other problems we just alluded to. And And folks are also able to lie with impunity. We have folks virtually every day, every week, saying things that basically are completely not true. But it takes weeks, months, years, decades for the truth to actually be unmasked. And my book is actually a lot about the real-time truth problem. We don't find out the truth usually till years later. And by then, the public has moved on or life has moved on, and it's too late. And in a democracy predicated on self-government and the public deciding what should happen in their government, that's not acceptable to not know the truth in real time, and that's sort of where we are.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Lewis, who's a best-selling author with over 30 years' experience as a national investigative journalist, a professor of journalism, and the founding executive editor of the Investigative Reporting Workshop at the School of Communication at American University. He's a former producer for ABC News and CBS's 60 Minutes, as well as the founder of the Center for Public Integrity and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. His new book just out is 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. But in terms of just optimism here, we're starting off with the dreadful truth about the state of discourse and the extent to which truth is a moving target. Truth is something that's managed, manipulated, and spun. There's a new word, a spin doctor. It's actually, instead of being a pejorative term, apparently, it's a term that we all accept. But given the digital revolution and the rise of nonprofit news media outlets like the UK Guardian, what's your sense then of this titanic battle, which the president, by the way, alluded to yesterday before the African summit? He gave a ringing endorsement of net neutrality. To your mind, would that be the final, you know, blow, the straw that breaks the camel back in terms of corporate control, total corporate control of information, if net neutrality goes out the window and the big telecoms and cable companies can basically regulate and just feed us infotainment?
Well, it certainly would be a pretty close to a death blow. We already have a rich media, poor media situation where we're developing a have-not multi-tiered system of information and ability to utilize the technologies as it is. But net neutrality is the last chance of trying to keep a level playing field. I'm not deep in the middle of that debate. I'm more into tracking all these things. But positive things that I think things like nonprofit journalism and truth commissions, 40 countries on earth, the citizens have gotten engaged and actually had their own truth commissions irrespective of what was said before, trying to clear the air. In the U.S., when I started the Center for Public Integrity from my house in 1989, it was the second nonprofit doing investigative reporting. Today there's 100 of them in the U.S. This is happening outside the U.S. in different countries. And you know, you mentioned The Guardian, NPR in the U.S., and public radio in general is one of the few media outlets to sources of information to double the audience since 9/11 in the U.S. I think the public generally does want the straight skinny. They want the information. They want to feel that it's professionally gathered, and they want to make sure that it's not spoon-fed from anybody's White House or any other place. And I think that there is a public yearning. The question is, are there enough people engaged in caring about this, and will they continue to be engaged, and will more come into it? Because clearly we have an unhealthy system in terms of our information and truth-telling in this country, the ability to do so, and we also have an attention span issue with the public, frankly. That's not unrelated. Sound bites have gone in the last 30 or 40 years from 40 seconds down to 8 seconds or less. And then, of course, and now some people think the tweeting is too long, 140 characters. Gosh, you could make it much shorter. And so I don't know where all this is going, but there are a lot of cross currents. And it's I'm hoping for the best. And my role or my mission, and to myself at least, is to try to enlarge the public space for accurate investigative information. I've been trying to do that for years, and I'm going to keep doing it.
And Chuck Lewis, your book, 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity, is very much needed. And we're very grateful for the work that you've done here because, you know, I was just watching John Oliver on this new HBO show talking about this new trend now where they're going to try and feed into the news essentially advertising and blur that line. And there was a debate amongst, I think it was the head of Time Inc., who was sort of saying, well, you know, the days of church and state separation are over.
your experience goes way back into ABC News, where you, its legendary news chief, Roone Arledge, killed a tough story on tobacco at the request of the so-called corporate guys. And I recall interviewing Lowell Bergman at the time when CBS's 60 Minutes killed the story on big tobacco lying and rigging results on the health effects. And that eventually was played on Frontline. And you, in your new book, you give a really stinging critique of 60 Minutes, CBS 60 Minutes, from your own personal experience, where they refused to broadcast a report that you had done on government officials profiting from U.S. lobbyists for foreign interests, because the legendary head of 60 Minutes, Don Hewitt, who's sort of an icon, or at least thought of as an icon in journalism, he didn't want his good friend Pete Peterson, the Wall Street billionaire, who's behind all of this propaganda about the skies falling over deficits and the guy that wants to eviscerate or privatize Social Security, he went to bat for his buddy, and you quit in protest. So this is all to say that the corporatization of our media has been inexorable for some time, has it not?
Well, it has. I mean, I have one chapter in particular that looks really closely at this problem, and it just looks at, well, it looks at a lot of things. One industry, 1940 to 2000, 60 years, multiple news organizations, print, the traditional print, newspapers and magazines, as well as TV networks, all finding themselves unable or unwilling to investigate the tobacco industry. This is a product, cigarettes, that smoking killed 100 million people in the 20th century, according to the World Health Organization. In this century, it'll be a billion people. That's just one industry. And, you know, in the book, I do have lots of other case studies of examples, people I know. I mean, I worked with Lowell Bergman at two networks. We were both at 60 Minutes, and Lowell's story is also in there, and I interviewed him yet again about the insider and all of that. But there was an attempt 8 years before, 7 or 8 years before the celebrated insider case with Lowell, where the owner of CBS, also an owner of a tobacco company, asked us to kill a tobacco story, and we ran it, and then I had a confrontation personally with Tisch and Mike Wallace at a social event. So there's been a smarminess and an incestuousness for years, and there has been a corporatization process that's been going on for decades, and you can absolutely see it, and I have seen it in my entire career, actually at all levels, going back to even local newspapers. And so that's a long, involved story, but you know, most papers in America went public between 1965 and 1995, and that meant they started worrying about their quarterly shareholder earnings, and they stopped worrying as much about covering the local community. They started gobbling each other up and, you know, merging and all that stuff, and they started developing efficiencies, meaning fewer reporters, more money for the shareholders, et cetera. And today we have half as many reporters covering every beat in the United States, cities, states, and in Washington. 27 states have no one covering their congressional delegation in Washington today. That is unbelievable. And so this process has become serious. It is a significant problem. And the public is sort of, in this case, an innocent bystander. This was a greedy industry that wasn't satisfied with 20, 30, 40, 50% annual profits. And they essentially did this to themselves. They didn't see the internet coming, which is fairly astonishing. And they didn't invest in R&D, research and development. And it's really a sad, sordid tale. But it goes all the way back to Edward R. Murrow talking about the same issues in the 50s. And basically, everyone ignored the prophets and the comments, prophets, P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, you know, who said, be careful here, look where you're headed. News should still matter to the public, and it's desperately needed for a democracy. And this has been something that has been on the wane for decades.
So, Charles Lewis, does this mean then that we are at the whims of the personal opinions of billionaires who buy the media or buy media assets? For example, you've got Rupert Murdoch, who's clearly had a profound effect on the media and driven the discourse to the right with Fox News. And I suppose in the good news column, the fact that it looks like he's given up his efforts to buy Time Warner may well come as music to a lot of people's ears. But if you go back to the days of Colonel McCormick, et cetera, there have always been these plutocrats who want to impose their opinions on the politics of the country through their media outlets. And are we therefore to assume that because of the fact that Bill Paley was seemed to be an enlightened man, that we are ultimately at the mercy of who the plutocrats are? Because, you know, we don't have a BBC, for example, that sets a kind of journalistic standard which others may be forced to follow. It seems that, you know, PBS and NPR and of course I'm with Pacifica, which is obviously is always having problems paying the bills. There's no money on the alternative side. There's endless amounts of money, certainly in Murdoch's coffers.
Well, you know, we've had a problem for a century about investigative reporting, generally speaking, does not engender goodwill with powerful financial titans. This goes back to Upton Sinclair in the jungle when he had trouble finding a publisher for that seminal work written in 1906 and resulting in food safety laws within 3 weeks. And so he had it privately funded. I mean, that is to say self-published. And so there has always been a friction between folks trying to do truth-telling and folks trying to make a buck. George Seldes, the great muckraking journalist, quit the McCormick family, you know, the Tribune, because he was being censored, similar kind of things. We could go all the way through history, but yeah, it's a problem. Bloomberg, private journalism around the world, 2,000, 2,500 reporters, whatever the total is, just had to censor a story in China recently, a few months ago, because their investors are so important in China, they didn't want to lose their access to China, and they were afraid they would upset the powers that be, and so they spiked the story pre-publication. So, and of course, there have been, you know, Bloomberg is worth $18 to $20 billion. So, folks of all stripes are the good news is they have money to enable lots of people in a newsroom. The bad news is they frequently have an agenda personally. That is not new, as you were saying. It goes back a century or more in the U.S. And the only thing we can hope for is that the public, both financially but also just in terms of interest and paying attention and caring, steps it up here, because otherwise we're all going to be corporatized in terms of information and what we're hearing. Today we have four times more public relations people than we did in 1960 when Kennedy and Nixon ran for president. Back then it was 1-to-1 in terms of the ratio of PR spinners to journalists. Today it's 4-to-1. So we have we have 50% of most news content, U.S., U.K., and Australia, is from press releases. So increasingly we are hearing in terms of quote-unquote news what folks want us to hear, and the independent truth-tellers and diggers of information that's not so apparent that maybe folks don't want to have told, it's hard to dig out. It takes time, and yes, it costs money. So somehow we've got to resolve this, and somehow we have to replenish the ranks of folks. We have the same number of reporters today as we had in 1972, the same year as Watergate. The problem is we've added 100 million citizens. The federal budget is 18 times larger, and so we have a really serious problem about folks watching those in power. We don't have enough, and we need more people and more money and more ideas and more creativity about ways to do this well.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Charles Lewis.
Well, thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Lewis, who's a best-selling author with over 30 years' experience as a national investigative journalist. He's a professor of journalism and the founding executive editor of the Investigative Reporting Workshop at the School of Communication at American University, and is a former producer for ABC News and CBS's 60 Minutes, as well as the founder of the Center for Public Integrity and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. His new book just out is 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how U.S. corporations are parking $2.5 trillion abroad to avoid paying taxes. Tell me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at the Institute for Global Leadership. He was a lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. And welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Glad to be here.
And the Obama administration is weighing plans to circumvent Congress to curtail tax benefits for U.S. Companies that relocate overseas to lower their tax bills. This was, of course, announced by Secretary of Treasury Jacob Lew on Tuesday. What do you think are the chances? I mean, it seems that the president is spending all of his time trying to circumvent Congress. What can he do in terms via executive orders to stop this migration of companies abroad? I mean, can he name and shame them, for example?
Well, I don't know if he needs to do that. He has a lot of flexibility under the IRS regulations to basically reinterpret, I think, some of the rules here that, or at least slow this process down. Basically, U.S. companies have, there's been a wave of at least discussions of inversions, and the inversions, we've had a total of 47 ever, but this year alone we have something like 12 up for grabs. Walgreens this week just decided not to do that. But the basic story is that if a U.S. company merges with a foreign company and the foreign shareholders end up owning more than 20% of the U.S. company and the merged company after the merger, then that opens the door to inversions. If they own more than 40%, then they can have the benefits of inversion tax-free. So essentially you have the United States corporation here is paying up to 35% corporate tax rate. If it moved to Ireland, it would pay 12%. And so there's a big benefit from that move. But in practice, one of the issues is that companies that would repatriate or to essentially invert to Ireland, for example, would then be paying their profits into the Irish headquartered company, and then they'd want to be borrowing to finance their U.S. operations because they're not moving anything but just the corporate headquarters. The way this makes economic sense is if they can lend to themselves and have the United States Treasury recognize that as a real loan and allow it to be tax deductible. And so I think the Treasury would have, some flexibility to say, no, that's not really a loan, arm's length loan from the foreign to the from your headquarter company. You really got to treat that as equity, and it's not going to be tax deductible. So that would upset a lot of these transactions. The preferable thing would be for the Congress to wade in here and prevent this. There's no doubt about that. They could do that by raising the limits on these offshore companies. But, this is, I think, a very aggressive move. It opens the door to essentially avoiding taxes on not only future profits, but the $2.5 trillion of accumulated profits that U.S. companies have parked offshore.
Well, that's not small change, is it? I mean,
no, it's a major loophole. The corporate lobbyists in Washington have been trying over the last decade or so to get a special kind of amnesty, a sort of a short-term tax cut on repatriated profits. They tried this in 2004. They got a 5% tax rate on repatriated profits. A third of that went to Pfizer, one company, and they proceeded to lay off 40,000 workers. So that didn't work out very well, but they've been arguing for another kind of temporary tax cut on repatriated profits. But this move toward inversions, you could have maybe 100 companies trying to do this. This is in many ways far more permanent and far worse. So it's definitely something that the administration, you know, has to get a hold of. I think there are a number of arguments against it, and you know, first of all, it hurts domestic companies that are competing with these foreign with these U.S. multinationals that are able to take advantage of this. It's you know, most domestic companies. There's something like 6 million corporations and limited liability companies in the United States. You know, the vast majority of them either have no assets, or, you know, 3.9 million of them that have less than 500,000 in assets, and those are all domestic companies. 85% of the assets are controlled by about 2,100 companies, and so that's really the core group that's potentially interested in this kind of tax cutting attitude.
So, just to get an idea of what we mean by a tax inversion, or you know, when companies go through these inversions, which is what the Senator Durbin is warning about, he said that the coming flood of corporate inversions justifies immediate executive action. He was joined with Elizabeth Warren and Jack Reed on that. For example, now, my understanding is that a company like Pfizer can literally park their formula for Viagra, put it in a vault in Switzerland, and then create a subsidiary company in Switzerland, and based upon the fact that document's in a safe somewhere in Switzerland, basically say that they're now a Swiss company, and then suddenly they don't have to pay local tax. I mean, that's a
kind of particular version of this that applies to companies with intellectual property like patents and brands and trademarks, and that's been going on for some time. The offshoring of intellectual property. I mean, you know, Google, for example, Apple offshored much of its intellectual property companies in Ireland and Bermuda, and basically on its offshore profits has reduced its tax rate that it pays to less than 1% by offshoring that. That's a little bit different from corporate inversions, which really refer to putting the whole corporate headquarters offshore. So this is a little more extreme than the intellectual property play, but in many ways this would be far worse, because an intellectual property case, you know, Apple's still here, they're still producing intellectual property here. It's you know, they're still paying substantial taxes in the United States on their U.S. income, even though they're deducting the royalties that they're paying abroad. The case of inversion, they would be moving everything, if Apple did it, to the Netherlands or to Ireland, where they'd pay a substantially lower tax rate globally, and you know, basically paying a whole lot less to the U.S. Treasury in particular. So, corporate inversions are kind of the limiting case of the intellectual property issue. You know, we're seeing in this context of companies wanting to go even farther toward basically having stateless income, where they don't pay any taxes anywhere. And in today's times, I think one of the reasons that this is a hot topic is, you know, the Times had a piece in arguing in favor of abolishing the corporate income tax by a fellow who's, you know, the son of a Nobel, of Robert Barrow. He's a Nobel laureate economist, very conservative guy. Repealing the corporate income tax is kind of where all of this is headed if we don't get a handle on it. And that's a really bad idea. You know, first of all, it would be a terrific, it would just open the door to all kinds of tax enforcement problems. Imagine you could set up a company and park all of your income in it and tax-free, and until you distributed it to yourself, you know, there would be no income tax. And that's the classic reason for having, one important reason for having corporate income taxes, is to avoid this attribution problem. It sounds technical, but it really means that anybody who wants to set up a company can put their, you know, can defer their taxes forever unless it's a corporate income tax. So this crazy notion of repealing the tax doesn't address that at all. You know, the second thing is that it would be a terrible terrible thing for developing countries that rely heavily on taxing multinationals. Because the way the corporate tax system works is now, if a U.S. multinational pays a, let's say, a tax in Brazil, they're able to deduct that from their U.S. corporate income tax. But if there is no U.S. corporate income tax, then it just means you're in a race to the bottom. Brazil is going to have to slash its corporate tax in order to get any revenue. So the, many of the developing countries rely very heavily on taxing multinationals, and this would be devastating to them.
Well, just in closing, James Henry, corporate taxes in the 1950s and 60s contributed over 40% of the revenues to the U.S. Treasury. In other words, they were a little under half of all the money that came into to run the U.S. government in the 1950s and 60s came from corporate taxes. And now I believe it's down something like 7% of income to the Treasury comes from corporate taxes. And my recollection is that the American dream was born in that era. Nobody ever complained in that era that America was going to hell in a handbasket and you needed to cut corporate taxes altogether. So isn't this part of an overall trend that the wealthy pay less and less and corporations pay less and less and the rest of us poor suckers pay more and more?
Well, I think it's a matter of shifting the tax burden to middle class and the poor. And oddly enough, you know, the tax rates in this country peaked in the 1970s and have been falling since then. The neoconservatives talked us into believing that tax cutting would actually help economic growth. In fact, we've seen tax competition spreading all over the globe. Country after country hacking its corporate and individual tax rates, transferring more of the burden onto sales taxes and to VAT taxes, you know, pension payroll taxes that can't be avoided by middle class people. And so, you know, this is very consistent. This is just one major reason why you not only have deficits going on, but you also have rising wealth inequality. And, you know, at some point we just have to wake up from this kind of fantasy we've been having for a long time that this kind of race to the bottom is going to pay off for everyone, not just the rich. It hasn't paid off, it's not paying off, and it's going to get worse if we adopt these kind of tax-cutting measures that are now on the table.
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and a former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and an Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. He was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.